Good morning and welcome to the Monday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. The best way to keep your retirement on track, even when the market stinks, by Walter Updegrave. Nearly 70% of more than 1,000 401k participants polled in a recent survey said they expected to be able to save enough to meet their financial goals in retirement. Problem is, those expectations may be based on overly optimistic assumptions about the rate of return their savings will earn. Indeed, two-thirds of those who participated in BlackRock's latest DC Pulse survey said they believe future gains will be in line with what they've seen in the past, and nearly 20% expect them to be higher. Which raises the question, are you putting your retirement in jeopardy by being overly optimistic about the returns your retirement accounts are likely to generate? There's no doubt the market's been on a roll in recent years. Since hitting bottom in the wake of the financial crisis 8 years ago, stock prices have more than tripled, giving stock investors an annualized gain of almost 18%, including dividends. And while bonds haven't performed as spectacularly, they've still managed a respectable average annual return of nearly 5% over the same period. But given today's lofty stock valuations, low bond yields, and modest prospects for economic growth, many, if not most, investment pros foresee more muted gains looking ahead. In its most recent quarterly outlook for investment returns, for example, asset manager BlackRock said it expects U.S. stocks to gain an annualized 5.9% over the next 10-plus years and bonds to return 3.1%. Fund giant Vanguard is slightly more optimistic about stocks in its 2017 outlook for the economy and the market, with a median forecast of an annualized 6.6% over the next decade, but it is less sanguine about bonds, with projected gains of just 2.1%. The upshot? You could very well be looking at returns that will not only trail those of recent years by a wide margin, but also fall well below the long-term historical averages of 10% a year for stocks and 5% for bonds over the past 90 years or so. So, what can you do to build a nest egg large enough to sustain you through retirement if the financial markets deliver significantly lower returns than in the past? Actually, let's start with what you shouldn't do, which is try to make up for below-average returns by investing more aggressively. While tilting your retirement portfolio dramatically towards stocks or loading up on volatile technology or small-cap growth stocks does have the potential to generate bigger gains, the volatility that comes with a higher-octane portfolio can also work against you and leave you worse off, especially if this aging bull market gives way to a bear market that can lop 50% or more off stock prices. The same caution applies to bonds. Moving from short and intermediate-term bonds to long-term issues that carry higher yields may seem like a surefire way to boost returns in a low-interest rate environment. But if interest rates tick up, which seems likely given that the Federal Reserve has signaled continued gradual increases in the federal funds rate, bond prices will fall, and bonds with the longest maturities will generally get hit hardest. Fortunately, there's a more effective approach to coping with anemic returns than throwing the dice and taking on more risk. Settle on a mix of stocks and bonds that makes sense given how much time you have before you retire and the level of volatility you're comfortable with, which you can do by going to a risk-tolerance asset allocation tool like the one Vanguard offers free online, and then invest as much as possible in funds with low annual costs. By opting for low-cost index funds and ETFs, for example, you may be able to reduce the amount you shell out in annual investment fees by a half to a full percentage point, if not more. And while there's no guarantee that every dollar you save in costs will translate to an extra dollar of return compared with more expensive funds, Morningstar research shows that low-expense funds typically outperform their high-fee counterparts, which increases the likelihood that you'll get the most out of whatever size gains the market delivers. As a practical matter, though, there's no way around the fact that building an adequate nest egg in an era of lower returns will also require you to save more. That's a matter of simple arithmetic. For example, if you stash $1,000 into a retirement account each month and earn an 8% annual return, you'll have roughly $181,000 after 10 years. If your return is 6% a year, your balance would slip to about $163,000. To end up with the same $181,000 with the lower 6% return, you'd have to save an additional $110 a month. It's difficult, if not impossible, to pinpoint exactly how much extra you might need to save to stay on track if returns come in well below past levels. The amount can depend on, among other things, how much you've already saved, how you invest your savings, how many years you have until retirement, and what sort of retirement lifestyle you envision. And even if you could gauge the necessary additional savings, there's the question of whether you can afford to devote more of your income to savings, considering that you've also got a life to live and bills to pay before you reach retirement. That said, if you're already putting a reasonable percentage of your income into retirement accounts, say 10 to 15%, throwing in an additional 2 to 3% of salary, or more if you can handle it, can go a long way toward countering the effect lower investment returns will have on the eventual size of your portfolio. If you can't manage such an increase all at once, you can always bump up your savings rate gradually, say increasing it by a percentage point every year or so, or saving half of any raises you receive. Unfortunately, pairing investment costs and pumping up your savings rates still may not be enough to compensate for lower returns. But that doesn't necessarily mean you're doomed to a grim retirement. There are additional steps you can take to boost the size of your portfolio, or at the very least make it last longer, such as staying on the job longer to give your retirement accounts more time to grow, and waiting a few years to claim Social Security to qualify for a larger benefit. And even after you retire, there are moves you can make to improve your prospects, such as working part-time, downsizing, taking out a reverse mortgage, or even moving to an area with lower living costs. Or you could just hope that the forecasts of more subdued returns in the future are overwrought or flat-out wrong. But if it turns out that you're the one who's mistaken, you may find yourself with no choice but to make some radical and unpalatable adjustments to salvage your retirement. Sheryl Sandberg, I Dread Father's Day, by Diane Tsai and Belinda Luscombe. One of the hardest things about losing a spouse is that at the same time you're grieving and feeling hideous, you have to look after your kids who have lost a parent. It's possible that you could find a new spouse, but a person can only ever have one biological father. Certainly, that's the case for Sheryl Sandberg, the Facebook CEO and author of Lean In, whose husband, Dave Goldberg, the widely admired CEO of SurveyMonkey, died unexpectedly while they were on vacation in Mexico in 2015. Sandberg's new book, Option B, written with psychologist Adam Grant, is about her struggle with grief, what she learned about overcoming adversity and fostering post-traumatic growth, and how to make a suffering person feel better. As a mother, you can be heartbroken for yourself, but I grew up with a dad and he's still alive, she told Time in an interview about her new book. And I'm heartbroken that I was not able to give my children the stability of growing up with two parents that they lived through and still are living through something so traumatic so young. In fact, the name of the book came from a conversation Sandberg had with one of her best friends, Phil Deutsch, a few weeks after Goldberg died. There was a father-child event at the kids' school, and Sandberg was upset that her husband couldn't be there. Deutsch put his arm around her. Option A is not available, he said. So let's just kick the shit out of Option B. Trump's Big Week. 100-Day Countdown, New Life for Healthcare Bill, and A Looming Shutdown, by Andrew Taylor and Alan Fram for the Associated Press in Washington. Lawmakers returning to Washington this coming week will find a familiar quagmire on health care legislation and a budget deadline dramatized by the prospect of a protracted battle between President Donald Trump and Democrats over his border wall. Trump's GOP allies control Congress, but they've been unable to send him a single major bill as his presidency faces the symbolic 100-day mark on April 29th, the very day when the government, in a worst-case scenario, could shut down. Feeling pressure to deliver results, Trump wants to revive a troubled health care measure from House Republicans to repeal and replace President Barack Obama's Affordable Care Act. Trump also hopes to use a $1 trillion catch-all spending bill to salvage victories on his promised U.S.-Mexico border wall, a multi-billion dollar down payment on a Pentagon buildup, and perhaps a crackdown on cities that refuse to cooperate with immigration enforcement by federal authorities. Congress faces a midnight Friday deadline to avert a government shutdown, but negotiations on the spending measure, a huge pile of leftover business from last year that includes the budgets of almost every federal agency, have hit a rough patch. Rank-and-file Republicans received few answers on a Saturday conference call by top House GOP leaders, who offered little detail and said deals remained elusive on both health care and the catch-all spending measure, with no votes scheduled yet. It's looking like a 1 or 2 week temporary measure will be needed to prevent a shutdown and buy time for more talks. Negotiations have faltered because of disputes over the border wall and health law subsidies to help low-income people afford health insurance. Trump's Capitol Hill allies had been tempering expectations that the president will win much in the budget talks. Democratic support will be needed to pass the spending measure, and Republicans fear taking the blame if the government shuts down on their watch. "We have the leverage and they have the exposure," House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi of California told fellow Democrats on a conference call Thursday, according to a senior Democratic aide. Pelosi wants the spending bill to give the cash-strapped government of Puerto Rico help with its Medicaid obligations, and Democrats are pressing for money for overseas famine relief, treatment for opioid abuse, and the extension of health benefits for 22,000 retired Appalachian coal miners and their families. An additional Democratic demand is for cost-sharing payments to insurance companies that help low-income people afford health policies under Obama's health law. The payments are a critical subsidy and the subject of a lawsuit by House Republicans. Trump has threatened to withhold the money to force Democrats to negotiate on health legislation. Trump's presidential victory makes it completely reasonable to ask and to insist that some of his priorities are funded, White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney said in an interview. "We are more than happy to talk to the Democrats about some of their priorities, but we encourage them to recognize that they are a minority party." Both the White House and Democrats have adopted hard-line positions on Trump's $1 billion request for a down payment on construction of the border wall, a central plank of last year's campaign. Talk of forcing Mexico to pay for it has largely been abandoned. But in an interview with the Associated Press on Friday, Trump stopped short of demanding that money for the project be included in the must-pass spending bill. Health care is on a separate track and facing trouble, too. The White House is pressing House Republicans to rally behind a revised bill so GOP leaders can schedule a vote this coming week that could let Trump fulfill a 100-day promise. A quick vote, let alone approval, seems unlikely. GOP leaders have shown no desire to revisit the issue until they're assured they have enough votes to succeed, a point House Speaker Paul Ryan, Republican Wisconsin, reiterated to lawmakers Saturday, according to participants in the call. An initial attempt in March ended in a legislative train wreck, stinging Trump and Ryan. The measure would have repealed much of Obama's 2010 overhaul and replaced it with fewer coverage requirements and less generous federal subsidies for many people. As part of the White House drive to resuscitate the bill, members of Trump's team, including Vice President Mike Pence and Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, have made multiple calls to Republicans. Two leaders of the House GOP's warring moderate and conservative factions devised a compromise during Congress's recess to let states get federal waivers to ignore some requirements of the health law. Those include one that now obligates insurers to cover specified services, such as for mental health, and one that bars them from raising premiums on seriously ill patients. But there are widespread doubts that the new attempt has achieved the support it needs. Representative Dan Donovan, Republican New York, an opponent of the bill, said last week that it doesn't cure the issues that I had concerns about. The moderate said his objections included changes to Obama's law that would still leave people with excessive out-of-pocket costs. The potential amendment was brokered by Representative Mark Meadows, Republican North Carolina, who heads the conservative House Freedom Caucus, and Representative Tom MacArthur, Republican New Jersey, a leader of the moderate House Tuesday group. Ryan called off a March 24th House vote on the measure after realizing that objections by conservative and moderate Republicans would have assured its defeat. Democrats were uniformly against the legislation. Find out if a robot will take your job, by David Johnson. At a community college in upstate New York, 12 cafeteria workers recently learned that they will lose their jobs and be replaced by self-serve machines. It's an issue that has played out in communities across the country as robots get better and better at doing jobs, from taking fast food orders to mining coal that once belonged to humans. Is your job next? The answer to that question is complicated, according to a report by management consultant McKinsey. But most workers don't need to worry. Experts found that less than 5% of jobs can be completely replaced by technology, though nearly every job involves tasks that robots could learn to do. Jobs with predictable activities in structured environments are the easiest to replace with robots, a process known as automation. McKinsey estimates that 51% of all job-related activities in the U.S. economy fit this description, largely in manufacturing, food service, and retail trade sectors. If you look at the specific jobs affected, you can get depressed, says Malcolm Frank, author of What to Do When Machines Do Everything. But if you look in a broader context, there's room for optimism. Frank points to the 1800s, when nearly 80% of U.S. labor was focused on agriculture. Today, that number is about 2%, yet we saw geometric growth in the U.S. economy. What the machine takes away, it also gives back with entirely new industries, entirely new types of jobs, he adds. Fields growing today include computing and data science, according to experts. While many of the robots' gains cut into blue-collar jobs, it's not all bad news for those workers, says University of Cincinnati economics professor Michael Jones. Electricians, plumbers, and contractors are not going to be replaced, he says. These workers solve unique challenges in varying environments, tasks difficult for machines. And white-collar jobs, in turn, are no longer necessarily safe from automation. We're starting to see companies help corporations make financial decisions and help IT companies manage cybersecurity, says Frank. Jones agrees, citing the example of Goldman Sachs, which replaced nearly 600 equity traders with software and 200 computer programmers. Even if a task can be automated, that doesn't mean it will happen overnight. Barriers to adopting new technology include the high cost as well as the response from clients who are accustomed to interacting with humans. Do consumers want a robot to give them a physical at the doctor's office or to take their order at a restaurant, Jones asks. Though self-serve kiosks have become much cheaper, restaurants still have to test how consumers feel about ordering from a tablet. That is, unless labor costs get really high, Jones says. Seattle's minimum wage is $15 an hour, twice the federal minimum wage. That might drive technology adoption much quicker. Though counterintuitive, Frank believes that automation will make us more creative in the long run. We're going to allow machines to do what machines do with excellence, and humans can do what humans do best. He gives the example of teachers who could benefit from a robot that reviews homework, helping to identify each student's needs. The rote work has been removed, he says, freeing up humans to do higher impact, more creative work. France throws the bums out and votes for a new political reality. By Vivian Walt in Paris. No matter whether centrist economist Emmanuel Macron or far-right National Front leader Marine Le Pen wins France's presidency in 2 weeks' time, Sunday's first-round election made history in France, ripping up the political system that has governed for generations over the world's sixth-biggest economy and a powerhouse of the European Union. Both the ruling socialists and the conservative Republicans suffered crushing defeats as millions of French voters expressed years of exasperation, fear, and disillusion by voting for insurgent or extremist candidates. The runoff round between Macron and Le Pen, Sunday's two top vote-getters, is on May 7th. As the polls closed at 8 p.m., the results appeared to be a collective cri de cœur against the establishment. This is huge, says Pierre Haski, political columnist for the news magazine La Obs, speaking to Time after the vote. The two parties that have dominated the political landscape for three or four decades have collapsed. The next president of France now seems highly likely to be Macron, who captured the most votes among 11 candidates on Sunday. That itself is a stunning new reality. Macron, just 39, would be France's youngest ever president by far if he is inaugurated on May 15th. What is more, he has never held elective office and has no traditional political party to call his own. He quit President François Hollande's government as economy minister last September to create his own political movement called En Marche, or On the Go, and drafted thousands of young French to knock on doors across the country, polling 100,000 people about how they wanted their country to change. It was a gamble that seems to have paid off, and now it could catapult this newcomer into power. It's hard to overstate the extraordinary and surprising nature of that accomplishment. In 1 year, we have changed the face of French politics, Macron told his ecstatic supporters at his victory party in Paris late Sunday night, saying that his win brought new hope for our country and for Europe. Amid the crowd of giddy supporters were many young French voting for the first time, who said in interviews they had been drawn to a candidate that appeared young and modern, a striking change from the fairly small group of grandees who have run the country for many years. The preliminary results Sunday night put Macron at 23.9%, Le Pen at 21.7%, and the Republican candidate François Fillon around 19%. The socialist candidate Benoît Hamon polled a disastrous 6%, a potential death knell for the party that has ruled France for 5 years. Fillon and Hamon, in somber concession speeches, admitted they were facing an entirely new political situation as outsiders. Both called on supporters to back Macron in the second round vote on May 7th. Standing in a hall in southern Paris, hundreds of Macron's young campaign volunteers broke into wild applause and cheers of Macron President as Fillon, projected on a large screen monitor on stage, said, "I will be voting for Emmanuel Macron." Indeed, Macron's lead over Le Pen on Sunday could potentially increase once all the votes are counted. That's because the early estimates do not include big cities like Paris, which are bastions of support for the former Rothschild investment banker, who is intent on modernizing the country and unraveling generations of state-heavy intervention. When Time profiled Macron last July, while he was still serving in Hollande's cabinet, he said he believed the current system was sclerotic and could not survive. "I am a newcomer," he told us then. "I want to remain a newcomer. It is in my DNA." Now, however, he will need to become the ultimate insider. piecing together a coalition to smash Le Pen's National Front in the runoff round and then to force through an agenda that could well spark violent protests. That includes loosening the way companies hire and fire employees, cutting back on steep wealth taxes for the richest French, and luring hundreds of thousands of French expats back home. Those include countless high-skilled professionals in Silicon Valley and London's financial hub, who left France in recent years frustrated by the lack of growth. Macron's ability to push through his programs will depend heavily on the parliamentary elections in June. His political movement, which currently has no representation, has scrambled in recent weeks to find candidates for the June vote. En Marche has received 15,000 people who want to be deputies, Macron campaign spokesperson Laurence Haim told Time earlier this week. We have commissions that are looking at each candidate, and we want parity and diversity to completely transform the face of political life in France. There is just one challenge, however, Le Pen. The 48-year-old won the biggest ever support for the National Front in Sunday's election. She has spent 6 years remaking the party from her father's far more rabidly racist and anti-Semitic movement into an electable force. In some ways, she succeeded in that on Sunday. Tapping into deep unease over the migrant crisis and terrorist threat, Le Pen stormed through the country arguing that France needed to close its borders and virtually halt all immigration, promising to hold a referendum to pull France out of the EU and drop the use of the euro. Speaking to her supporters on Sunday night after the vote, Le Pen vowed she would take her support all the way to the Élysée. Globalization puts our country in danger, she thundered to a packed hall in northern France. That message clearly hit home with millions of voters on Sunday. When Time traveled the hard-hit Rust Belt of northern France in February, many Le Pen supporters said they believed global free trade, which Macron supports, had failed French workers. We don't think that finding workers that are cheaper and cheaper with worse working conditions is a good thing for the people of the world, National Front activist Eric Richemont, 24, told Time then. The National Front is the only party that gives people hope in these elections, he said. Now Macron will need to reckon with that fury, even if he succeeds in winning the presidency. And there is fury, too, on the other side of the political spectrum. 19.2% voted for the far-left politician Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who fought to nationalize major industries and to reconsider France's EU membership. He has to take into account the anger of people who voted for Le Pen and Mélenchon, Haski says. In addition, he says, Le Pen has attempted to cast herself as France's Trump, the candidate of change, versus a Hillary Clinton-type opponent, the embodiment of an old establishment. She has said frequently, including to Time in recent months, that she regarded Trump's victory as a sign that she too could prevail against all odds. She portrays this election as a replay of the U.S. election, Trump versus Clinton, Haski says. That is a trap that Macron does not want to fall into. CNN anchor Allison Camerota, Roger Ailes did sexually harass me, by Alana Abramson. CNN co-anchor Allison Camerota said she was sexually harassed by Roger Ailes, the former Fox News CEO who resigned last year amidst similar allegations from other women. Roger Ailes did sexually harass me, Camerota told CNN's Brian Stelter on Sunday. He was often kind of grossly inappropriate with the things he would say, and I think many of us experienced that. Camerota, who worked at Fox News for over a decade, said when she first started at the cable news network, she went to Ailes' office and told him she wanted more opportunity. She said he responded by telling her they would need to work together really closely, which would require them going to a hotel. Do you know what I'm saying? Camerota said Ailes asked her. Camerota said she wondered if declining his advances would jeopardize her career. Will I be fired if I don't do this? She recalled thinking at the time. Ailes resigned last July amidst accusations of sexual harassment from several women. Two of the network's former female anchors, Megyn Kelly and Gretchen Carlson, also said he made unwanted sexual advances towards them. Roger Ailes attorney Susan Estrich denied Camerata's allegations, calling them unsubstantiated and false. Mr. Ailes never engaged in the inappropriate conversation she now says occurred, and he vigorously denies this fictional account of her interaction with him and of Fox News editorial policy, the statement said. Camerata's disclosure comes after the ouster of former Fox News anchor Bill O'Reilly, who was axed by the network last week. He faced intense scrutiny and an advertising boycott after a New York Times report revealed he had paid five women a collective $13 million for agreeing not to file lawsuits or speak publicly about harassment allegations. Camerata said on CNN's New Day earlier this week that O'Reilly had never harassed her. She also revealed that Ailes would emotionally harass her when he didn't feel she was espousing his worldview on air, and told her she could be a role model if she would be more conservative. He targeted me because he sort of figured out early on that I didn't share his worldview, Camerata said Sunday. Camerata left Fox News 3 years ago, noting that her decision to leave was partially a result of her uncomfortable interactions with Ailes. She decided to finally go public with her story because O'Reilly's dismissal showed her that Fox News executives do seem to want to change the culture. It felt like there was a tipping point this week, she said. It felt as though the Murdochs really want to know what the culture was like, and I don't know how you get that with silence. This article first appeared on Fortune.com. CNN anchor Allison Camerata, Roger Ailes Did Sexually Harass Me, by Alana Abramson. CNN co-anchor Allison Camerata said she was sexually harassed by Roger Ailes, the former Fox News CEO who resigned last year amidst similar allegations from other women. Roger Ailes did sexually harass me, Camerata told CNN's Brian Stelter on Sunday. He was often kind of grossly inappropriate with the things he would say, and I think many of us experienced that. Camerata, who worked at Fox News for over a decade, said when she first started at the cable news network, she went to Ailes' office and told him she wanted more opportunity. She said he responded by telling her they would need to work together really closely, which would require them going to a hotel. "Do you know what I'm saying?" Camerata said Ailes asked her. Camerata said she wondered if declining his advances would jeopardize her career. "Will I be fired if I don't do this?" she recalled thinking at the time. Ailes resigned last July amidst accusations of sexual harassment from several women. Two of the network's former female anchors, Megyn Kelly and Gretchen Carlson, also said he made unwanted sexual advances towards them. Roger Ailes' attorney, Susan Estrich, denied Camerata's allegations, calling them unsubstantiated and false. Mr. Ailes never engaged in the inappropriate conversation she now says occurred, and he vigorously denies this fictional account of her interaction with him and of Fox News editorial policy, the statement said. Camerata's disclosure comes after the ouster of former Fox News anchor Bill O'Reilly, who was axed by the network last week. He faced intense scrutiny and an advertising boycott after a New York Times report revealed he had paid five women a collective $13 million for agreeing not to file lawsuits or speak publicly about harassment allegations. Camerata said on CNN's New Day earlier this week that O'Reilly had never harassed her. She also revealed that Ailes would emotionally harass her when he didn't feel she was espousing his worldview on air, and told her she could be a role model if she would be more conservative. "He targeted me because he sort of figured out early on that I didn't share his worldview," Camerata said Sunday. Camerata left Fox News 3 years ago, noting that her decision to leave was partially a result of her uncomfortable interactions with Ailes. She decided to finally go public with her story because O'Reilly's dismissal showed her that Fox News executives do seem to want to change the culture. It felt like there was a tipping point this week, she said. It felt as though the Murdochs really want to know what the culture was like, and I don't know how you get that with silence. This article first appeared on Fortune.com. South Korea says there's a chance the North will conduct its sixth nuclear test on Tuesday. By Kim Tong-hyung for the Associated Press in Seoul. Fresh off an immense North Korean parade that revealed an arsenal of intercontinental ballistic missiles, rival South Korea and its allies are bracing for the possibility that Pyongyang's follow-up act will be even bigger. North Korea often marks significant dates by displaying military capability, and South Korean officials say there's a chance the country will conduct its sixth nuclear test or its maiden test launch of an ICBM around the founding anniversary of its military on Tuesday. Such moves could test the developing North Korea policies of President Donald Trump, who has reportedly settled on a strategy that emphasizes increasing pressure on Pyongyang with the help of China, North Korea's only major ally, instead of military options or trying to overthrow the North's government. Trump spoke by phone with both the Japanese and Chinese leaders Monday. China's official broadcaster CCTV quoted President Xi Jinping telling Trump that China strongly opposed North Korea's nuclear weapons program and hoped all parties will exercise restraint and avoid aggravating the situation. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and Trump agreed to urge North Korea to refrain from what Abe called provocative actions. The North Korean nuclear and missile program is an extremely serious security threat to not only the international community but also our country, the Japanese leader told reporters in Tokyo afterward. Recent U.S. commercial satellite images indicate increased activity around North Korea's nuclear test site, and third-generation dictator Kim Jong-un has said that the country's preparation for an ICBM launch is in its final stage. Seoul's defense ministry has said the North appears ready to conduct such strategic provocations at any time. South Korean Prime Minister Hwang Kyo-ahn, the country's acting leader in place of ousted President Park Geun-hye, who has been arrested over corruption allegations, has instructed his military to strengthen its immediate response posture in case the North does something significant on the April 25th anniversary. There's also a possibility that North Korea, facing potential changes in regional dynamics as Washington presses Beijing to pressure Pyongyang more aggressively, opts to mark the anniversary with a missile launch of lesser magnitude. North Korea separately fired what U.S. officials said were a Scud-type missile and a mid-range missile earlier this month, but the launches were analyzed as failures. While Trump has dispatched what he called an armada of ships to the region, including an aircraft carrier, U.S. officials have told the Associated Press that the administration doesn't intend to militarily respond to a North Korean nuclear or missile test. In a statement released late Friday, North Korea's foreign ministry accused Trump of driving the region into an extremely dangerous phase with his sending of the aircraft carrier and said the North was ready to stand up against any kind of threat posed by the United States. With typical rhetorical flourish, the ministry said North Korea will react to a total war with an all-out war, a nuclear war with nuclear strikes of its own style, and surely win a victory in the death-defying struggle against the U.S. imperialists. Under the watch of Kim, North Korea has been aggressively pursuing a decades-long goal of putting a nuclear warhead on an ICBM capable of reaching the U.S. mainland. North Korea conducted two nuclear tests last year alone, which would have improved its knowledge on making nuclear weapons small enough to fit on long-range missiles. It also last year launched a long-range rocket that delivered a satellite into orbit, which Washington, Seoul, and others saw as a banned test of missile technology. On April 15th, North Korea offered a fresh look at its advancing nuclear weapons and missiles program in a massive military parade in Pyongyang honoring late state founder Kim Il-sung, the grandfather of the current ruler. The displayed military hardware included prototype ICBMs and new mid-range solid-fuel missiles that can be fired from land mobile launchers and submarines, making them harder to detect before launch. The parade also featured previously unseen large rocket canisters and transporter erector launcher trucks, or TELs. This indicated that North Korea was developing technologies to cold launch ICBMs, ejecting them from the launch tubes before they ignite in midair, which would prevent its limited number of ICBM-capable launcher trucks from being damaged and also allow the missiles to be fired from silos. Analysts say that the North is also likely developing solid-fuel ICBMs and that some of the canisters might have contained prototypes. North Korea had earlier shown signs it was working on a new ICBM. In March, the North state media reported that the country successfully conducted a ground test of a new high-thrust rocket engine, which it said was a breakthrough for the country's space program and efforts to create Korean-style strategic weapons. Kim was then quoted as saying, "The whole world will soon witness what eventful significance the great victory won today carries." While North Korea almost certainly needs more time to create a solid-fuel ICBM, test launches for its existing liquid-fuel ICBMs, including the KN-08s and KN-14s, could come much sooner. Experts say these missiles could one day be capable of hitting targets as far as the continental United States, although North Korea has yet to flight test them. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.